what we ended up, this begins Yiftach part 6, I think. So with this, I'd like to close. And we saw a number of midrashim. Yeah, last time we saw the Ibn Ezra's approach and the whole narrative of Yiftach last time. And with this, the complexity and the tragedy of the whole event of the narrative itself. Now, coming to that, there are actually just three parallels externally which are just worthwhile thinking about. I know some of you mentioned them to me before, and so I just wanted to bring them into play. And that is that there is a story which takes place in Melachim Beis, and it's a story where what's actually quite a fascinating story where the northern and southern kingdom join together in battle, which is very unusual. So the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Yehuda joined together. Not only do they join together with each other, they join together unusually with with Edom, which is usually not the people that they spend time with. So what happens is they wage war on Moab, and they call Elisha. I'm trying to say, remember, it was the prophet. It was just after Eliyahu. Yes, they call Elisha, and Elisha tells them they're going to win this battle. And Moab loses this battle terribly. But upon the loss of this battle, the last thing that occurs is the last pasuk. This is in Melachim Beis Gimel Chav Zayin. This is not in the source notes, but it says as follows: Vayikach es benoi habachor Hashem ilach tachtov. So let me actually back up a pasuk. It says that the king of Moab saw that the kichazak alav hamilchamat, the war was just too strong for him. So he took took 700 sword-bearing soldiers, lavkias melech Edom v'loyachlu, and they tried to wage war against the king of Edom, didn't succeed. Okay, because Edom and Moab are our neighbors. They tried to wage war, didn't succeed against Edom. And the last ditch effort, what does he do? He takes his firstborn son, Shimiloch Tartov, who would rule in his place, and he sacrificed him as a burnt offering on the wall. There's a great anger against against Israel. And they moved away from them and returned to the land. So what really went on in this pasuk over here? What really occurred? So the Mefarshei Apshat say that the son who was sacrificed wasn't the son of Moab himself. It was the son of Edom, because what had happened was there was a peace treaty going on that Edom and Moab were supposed to be allies, and so therefore, as part of that a part of that partnership, the son of Edom came to Moab and stayed in Moab's kingdom. When Moab now sees that Edom is now fighting with Israel and Judah together, what happens? He takes the son who was, so to speak, this mashkon in his place, and kills him in his eyesight as a punishment for rebelling against him. That's what the Mefarshei Apshat say was the problem. What is the anger against Israel? It's actually Edom. This is now the breaking point of the partnership of Edom and Israel, which is what Moab was trying to do. Was by killing the son of Edom, which now means to say that Israel is liable, so to speak, for putting him in such a position that broke the partnership of Edom and Israel. So that's just a fascinating thing. However, Chazal and a number of the Mefarshim who followed this particular approach say that it wasn't the son of Edom that was being killed over here; it was the son of Moab himself. Meaning, Moab's losing the battle, he takes up his firstborn, the prince, the person who's supposed to take his place. Kill him on the wall as maybe some form of sacrifice, of appeasement to his God. But that's what we have over here, which is just, you see this notion of child sacrifice occurring over here. And in fact, the Gemara does link these two, links Yiftach in this case, which is fascinating, because the Gemara in Tanis, I'm sorry, these do not appear on the source packets, but the Gemara in Tanis says, quoting a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, saying, there are certain things that God never thought about, never commanded, never wanted to occur. And the Gemara darshans out every one of those three sayings. One of them, that which I didn't command, is referring to Mesha, the king of Moab's son. that I didn't even think about was referring to Yiftach sacrificing his daughter. And finally, V'lo also Alibi, that the last part of the pasuk is Yitzchak ben Avraham, that he didn't even want Avraham to have the Akedah, which is fascinating because it sounds like Hashem wants the Akedah to occur at the beginning at least. But it seems like from this Gemara that it's clear, based on this the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, that he didn't want, Hashem never wanted that to occur. He never wanted the Akedah to occur. And somehow, these people...
Gives a lot of power to the Satan, if that's
right. Right. So meaning, say further.
Well, I mean, the Midrash is that it's the Satan that sort of created that situation. And if they're saying that Hashem never even wanted it to happen, then it wasn't even within...
Yes. So that you're right. So to the degree that the Satan was allowed to be involved over there, you see things like this as well with Eov, to the degree that he was able to control over Eov's life in order to get him to a certain point, which is, shows you the tremendous control that he may have. But right, exactly that point. It shows you the degree of power that occurs over there. But what just fascinating about all these three incidents is that Hashem is almost shouting in grievance. How could it be that my children or people or humanity should reach these things? And all these three incidents are put in one bag. Interestingly, that Yitzhak never occurred, right? Yitzhak never actually happened, but Yiftach and Mesha did occur. Well, another interesting thing just to think about is, although this occurs many, many years later, it is Moab. Moab is the sister nation of Ammon, which they're fighting against over here. We're not going to say Yiftach learned from this, but maybe Mesha learned from Yiftach. I don't know if one could say something like that. It's worthwhile thinking about that the Gemara sees these as parallel mistakes which have occurred over here. So that's one thing which requires thought. Anyways,
it's also interesting to think that animals are okay, but people aren't, which seems like a given because we're people. Mm-hmm. But in reality, why?
Mm-hmm. So the Torah takes it as a given, right? I mean, the Torah tells us about animal sacrifice. So you're questioning why in the first place, right?
So we have greater intelligence or the ability to understand right from wrong and make choices and etc. But if you're sacrificing already, which I guess I have such a, like many of us today, this idea of even sacrificing animals is so foreign to us. Where's the line that it's like, well, that's okay, but that's not okay?
Right. So it does seem, just to bring it into a different context, I hear your question, is to bring it into a different context. The Ramban, when discussing Shiloach HaKain, sending away the mother bird, describes how, in a certain sense, that we live in a human-centric world, meaning the world is here to serve humans to the ability that it exists now. This doesn't mean to say we can abuse it, but that means to say that, the Ramban says, well, he's describing what the Rambam says, you need to send away the mother bird. Why? Because there's an instinctual connection between mother and child, and you need to send it away. So the Ramban says, well, if we're concerned about the feelings of animals, then why would we be able to eat them? It must be that we're able to eat them because they're there to serve that purpose. So now the question is, how far do you expand purpose, right? Mm-hmm. So sacrifice, at least, and certainly the way the Torah views it, is purpose. Right. The question is the question starts in trying to understand that as a purpose, more than the
eating immediately, as soon as I thought about eating, even before you, that immediately is the distinction also. We don't eat people, but we eat animals.
And so interestingly enough, that was a development as well, meaning we didn't start off eating animals.
Right, that's what I
That was a necessary development because of our inability to be able to distinguish.
Well, because originally, I think we were given permission to eat animals because we were eating them anyway.
Interesting.
Why would you surmise that we were eating them already?
That's what
Hashem created everything for the usage of man. That was in the creation. So that was, everything was all inclusive.
Correct.
But he didn't give us permission.
But we weren't able to eat the animals, meaning animals at that point in time may have been our work utensils in a sense, meaning at the greatest. But it seems like, now I haven't faint suggesting that it might have been because we were already doing it. I hadn't seen that approach. I'd be interested in looking into that. And if you found that, I would find where you heard that from. I'd be very interested. Generally, the way I've understood it from some of the Mefarshim is that there was a certain amount of bestiality which occurred before the flood. And the bestiality is, in a certain sense, a loss of the the value of humanity as distinct entity or distinct species. And therefore, because of that, the being able to eat them was to create that division a little more accentuated. So that's the way I've understood it, but I would be interested to understand that further, which goes into a little bit of what we were discussing last week about the distinctions between humanity. But the point of this is that the Ramban understands that the fact that we're allowed to eat animals, and the Torah mandates eating animals, means to say that we live in a human-centric world, that the world is created in order to serve humans. The problem is when it comes to abuse of that privilege, right? That's when things go awry. So that's when you get into environmentalism and how the Torah treats it. And the Torah is actually quite severe about not misuse and abuse, not just of animals, but of the world as a whole. But that would be because we are given it to control and use for our purpose. But once the moment is not for our purpose, then anything else. So where sacrifice fits into that is that sacrifice is part of this, the purpose of the creation, and we have lost a certain sense of appreciation of it today, which even I myself is a hard thing to understand fully in today's society. But there's a lot of interesting layers of that. Anyways, so just wanted to bring back into over here. We have this tragedy of human sacrifice 2.5 times in history, we'll call it, which Hashem mourns publicly in Yirmiyahu. And finally, just another parallel which is worth thinking about, and some people have mentioned this to me, and I value that, is the story later on in Greek mythology of Iphigenia, which there's a number of different versions of this, by the way, just to be more careful about this. There are a number of different versions of the story, but the most common version of the story of Iphigenia is that her father, whose name this is in Euripides, her father Agamemnon was made a vow that he would sacrifice her in order to get into Troy. That was the only way he could get in. So he tricked her mother to say that she'd get to marry Achilles, brought her out, and then he regretted it, but it was too late, and she mourned with her mother over the decision. Achilles tried to defend her, and at the end of the day, they did not succeed, and she made the choice to be sacrificed in order that all the children and all the soldiers could get into Troy, and there would not be a great battle. So it was the terrible tragedy, Greek tragedy of self-sacrifice of Iphigenia. But in the end of the day, you should know all ends happily, because I think she was saved and a deer was put in her place. And she actually, there's lots of different versions of the story. Anyway, so just there are different versions of the story. I have heard people who suggest that the Yiftach story was a later addition based on Greek mythology. I don't think that's academically or intellectually honest. Just because the amount of years that occurred between, first of all, we believe that Tanakh was written by the Nevi'im. And second of all, just even on an academic level, if that wasn't a value to you, it's really, we're talking about more than 1,000 years. We're talking about a huge amount of time that somebody's just going to edit in a Greek mythology. What would make more sense, and I think just on an academic level, is just to realize is that there are certain paradigms of stories which occur and reoccur and reoccur. This is the first time we see this happening, and that plays itself out in history again and again and again. And Greek mythology picks up on a lot of these things.
Anyway, the story of the flood is in many, many human cultures, so that proved your point.
Right. So so then there's a discussion which came first, and that's what academics deal with. But over here, I think it should be an open and a shut book case of this paradigm of tragedy expressing itself in Greek mythology. But it is interesting because there are a lot of people who parallel the Iphigenia episode and the daughter of Yiftach. Now those are things which were mentioned to me. I think were worthwhile just being aware that they're out there. But this is something to me now to close this. I think there's actually a more intriguing parallel in all of this, and I think this is actually maybe a narrator's point over here. The Navi is pointing out something to us over here, which otherwise we wouldn't have known it. And that is that when Yiftach makes his original neder, Yiftach makes the neder and he says, let's just requote those words when he. When he says those words about his daughter, let me skim back to it. This is in it's Pasuk Lamed. So every seat over there, it's in Pasuk Lamed of the main parak of Yud Aleph. It says Vayidar Yiftach Neder LaHashem. He made this an oath to God. If you, Hashem will surely give the Bnei Amon in my hands, which is already a parallel phraseology to the Jews, the nation of Israel in the desert, when a nation attacked them. But listen to this. That which will leave the doors of my house when I return in peace, it will be to God. I'll sacrifice them as an ola. Those words, Hayotzei Asher Yotzei Midalsei Beisi, also appear another time in Tanakh, which I think is very fascinating. Anybody, any recollection where that may be? Where else in Tanakh do we have Yotzei Asher Yotzei or Yotzei Midalsei Beisi, somebody stepping out of the walls of a house in a little bit of a different context? So I think this is very fascinating because I hear the way where you're coming from. I hear where you're coming from. It's a similar kind of idea of destruction occurring on the outside, and that is in Sefer Yehoshua. Do you remember that in Sefer Yehoshua? And I actually put this in the sources just to take a quick look at this. If you'll turn to the sources near the end, it's called Narrator's Interpretation of the Neder. And it's got three boxes which say Yehoshua. Let me just tell you the exact page right now. The exact page will be on 11. Okay, thank you very much. Yes, on page 11 there in the middle, Narrator's Interpretation of the Neder. So I think this is a very fascinating thing. What happens is that the just to recall, two meraglim are sent to the city of Yericho, which is the first attempted conquest in the land of Israel, and they're saved by a person called Rahab, who happens to be a zana, right? So prostitute, innkeeper. Remember the whole discussion we had before. And she is now letting down the ladder, and she says, "You've got to save my family." So as she lets them down the rope, they respond to her. It's interesting, they're actually on the ground. They could run away now, but they say to her, "Vayamru eleho ha'anashim." So this is on page 11. Nikiim anachnu mishvua seichazeh asheish batanu. We're free. We're clean from this shvua that you made us take. Hinei anachnu ba'im ba'aretz. And we're going to enter the land, meaning in conquest. Es tikvas chut ha'shani hazeh tikshari b'chalon asher radetenu bo. Put a red thread on the window that you let us down. Put all your parents, your mother, your father, your brothers, your sisters, everything in your, who you, every person you want to survive, leave them in your house. Anyone who leaves your house, leaves the doors of your house going outwards, Dama Barosha. Their blood will be on their head, meaning they're responsible and liable for their own death. And in that case, we will be cleansed of our shvuah of protection. But anything in the house, we take responsibility for. If anything will happen to them. So now, just the words not enough for a parallel there necessarily. But you should also realize that the way this, what happens over here is that there's also a cherem which occurs also in Yehoshua as well. The next source talks about it, which is when Yehoshua is describing the destruction of Yericho, he says as follows. It will be on the seventh time of what?
Walking
around, right? Because on the seventh day they encircle the city seven times. Taku ha-kohanim b'shafar, all the kohanim will blow on the shafars. V'yom Yehoshua la'am, ha-riu ki-nosan Hashem lachem es-ha'ir. When the shafars are blown, you should all scream out, because that's when Hashem is giving you the city. The city will be a cherem. Now, what do we know when a person says cherem about a city of your enemies? What does that mean? That means to say you can't loot it. You kill every person, and the loot is not to be taken home. Okay, that's what it means. Remember, that was the second option of cherem that we saw in the Torah, when the Torah describes how cherems work. V'kol asher bo la Hashem, everything shall be to God. Rak rachav azanot tichye, he v'kol asher ito b'bayis. He, everything she has and everything in her house. Because she hid our slaves. She was a double agent. Our messengers. You should guard yourselves from the cherem. Don't take from anything which is designated to Hashem. But sometimes Machane Israel, if you were to take for the cherem, then what would happen? You would block it up, or you'd make it accursed. And which is in fact what happens. Somebody takes from it and causes a curse on the Jewish people. Now, a fascinating point over here is you see again, you see a cherem given by a leader on a city, but over here, the cherem doesn't affect that which is inside the house. Only that which goes outside of the house is going to be affected by the cherem. I just think it's a very fascinating thing, just to think about for a moment, is Yiftach's making a cherem on anything that goes out of his house as well. It's just interesting, using the same words, the same idea of somebody walking out of the doors of the house and this cherem, but again, Yiftach is a mismatched cherem. It's a misuse, as we saw. I mean, there's some sort of misunderstanding in it. Also fascinatingly, is in the actual description of Yiftach and his daughter, if you just flip back for one moment, is when he's describing what happens when he first sees his daughter. Let's just go back to that. It's on page 5. It's in Lamed Hay. Just one second. It says in Lamed Hay, Vayihi so when he sees his daughter coming out, Vayikras begadav, he tears his clothes, Vayomer, and he says, Aha b'ni, woe my daughter, alas, Hachrei chratani, you've brought me down, Va'at hayis ba'ochrai. You were my troubler, so to speak. That is the same word that Yeshua says for anybody taking from the cherem, right? Anybody who takes from the cherem, Yeshua is going to be achartem. You're going to create this curse on the nation of Israel. Over here, when Yiftach sees his daughter, who's walked out of the house, entering the cherem, he says, you are my ochrai. You're the one who brought the curse, so to speak, on me. You brought this trouble on me. Just there's three interesting parallels over here. And the question is, why would this be significant? Why is it significant that Tanakh frames Yiftach, which is coming afterwards, in the same words as Yehoshua coming earlier? Okay, you see there's three parallels over here. There's the cherem outside, anybody walking outside of that gets killed. And then finally this idea of ochrai, of the person who, so to speak, breaks the cherem, being the person who creates the trouble.
He's projecting.
So
Yiftach is projecting.
Well, is Yiftach's not writing. Shmuel's writing this, and he's couching it in the same terms as the Yeshua episode. So I'd like to ask Shmuel, why is it that you see it important that we remember Yeshua when reading the Yiftach incident specifically with his daughter? So
everybody, one person did something and everybody suffered.
Okay, so I'd like to take that a little further. It's actually interesting because you see, when Yeshua made this cherem, who was he listening to? God was he obeying the word of Hashem?
No,
we don't have it in the Pesukim
over
here. Right. So actually, if you'll notice it, Hashem doesn't tell in this part. Hashem says, "You circle the city one per day, and then seven times on the last day, and then you'll destroy the city." Yeshua added on a cherem. Now, what's fascinating about this is if you continue, if you continue to the last paragraph describing Yeshua over here, is what occurs afterwards is that the nation of Israel fights a city called Ha'ai. They lose the battle, losing a number of casualties. And at that point in time, this is now in the last paragraph quoting Yeshua, Vayikra Yeshua Simnasov, and Yeshua tears his garments, Vayipol al tzponov aratzol lifnei Aaron Hashem ad ha'erev, and he falls on his face in front of the Aaron of God until the evening. Hu v'zignei Yisrael v'ayelu afar al rosham. They're all in mourning, meaning they're not just mourning for the people, but they're also mourning for in a certain sense, the loss of the winning legacy. In a certain sense, it's like they've been rejected. They've lost their step into the land. Skipping just a few psukim, because Yeshua makes his whole claim to Hashem in between. Hashem says to Yeshua, "Vayomer Hashem el Yehoshua." God says to Yeshua in response to all his claims, Kumlach, get up. Why are you falling on your face? Chata Yisrael v'gamaravrues brisi asher tzivis yasam. They transgressed my covenant that I commanded them. V'gam lakchu min acherem. They took from the cherem v'ganvu v'gam kichashu. They stole and they denied v'gam samul bichleim, and they put in their vessels. What does it mean when it says Hashem says to Yeshua, get up, stand up? So the Chazal and Rashi and Rambam Farshim, following this approach, present a few approaches here which seem to suggest that there's a certain amount of guilt on Yeshua's shoulders. The words Kum Yeshua sounds like, get up, you did something to cause this. What did Yeshua do to cause this? And they say, the Chazal say, is that you made a cherem that not everybody could live to. Meaning,
there is that distinction in the next.
So. In the next, exactly. Well, so let me play out what you're saying. That
says CBT, and you also took from the Chayrab.
Yes, so you see, okay. So that's interesting over here. You see, that they transgressed the bris that I commanded them. So is the commanded them going on the Chayrab as well? So in some Mepharshim say yes. Once Yeshua said it, Hashem said, you know what? You chose to do that. I agree to the Chayrab even. Some people say that. Some of the Mepharshim distinguish and they say the bris was commanded. But the point is that he made something which there was a one family among the nation of Israel who couldn't withstand that. And therefore, the loss that occurred because of that was his responsibility to some degree. Meaning, Yeshua should have been able to assess the nation of Israel more effectively to know that such a cherem would be too difficult, at least on the first conquest. And therefore, when Achan actually takes from the cherem, breaking that cherem, then in a certain sense, it's the responsibility of Yehoshua. Yeah. Now, you see that as well, it is still called the Cherem which Hashem commands, according to a large number of the Mepharshim, that still Hashem condones this Cherem that Yehoshua puts on, which I think is important because maybe the reason why Shmuel, when framing the story of Yiftach, recalls these parallels to Yehoshua, it's to show us the complexities of it. Because although, as we've seen, there's been a number of indications that Yiftach was grossly wrong, either in making it or in not fixing it up or not consulting, all the different things that he could have been incorrect about, but at the same time, it's being framed in the context of something which was altruistic, just misguided or or the assessment was not correct, it was not on target. Meaning, he may have been thinking about something else coming out of his house. Yes. It may have been giving a sacrifice to Hashem. What we're trying to frame over here is that there was a cherem which was supposed to be something. It wasn't grossly off the mark. It was something which had the right intent, but went wrong. And when it went wrong, he didn't fix it. Then he went completely off the path.
Why could he just have said, if he wins, I will make it,
but he didn't.
You're right. Well, that's the problem. But that's the problem. And again, the question you'd ask is you'd ask Yeshua as well. Why couldn't Yeshua be more careful, perhaps, when that's what Hashem's saying, when making his cherem? So I just think it is meaningful that when this story is written, there are parallels to another story where there was an altruistic cherem placed, but it wasn't correctly assessed, which led to the guilt that was laid on Yeshua's shoulders. I think that is a meaningful point is to consider when seeing how it's framed. Well, over here.
You know what, and it lies to, or it speaks to the power of man, that Hashem accepts that, because although Hashem didn't command this, once man does that, he
and
accepts
Hashem
it
jumps
as,
into that.
As equal to whatever I say, to
correct.
Some degree.
Well, correct, correct.
Man's law. They were both on high, Yeshua and Yiftach. They were on the top at this moment. They just let themselves go.
Right, just before a battle as well. Meaning that they had the ability, and as Ruth is saying, is that they had the ability to be able to, so to speak, pull God in with them. But, to a certain degree, because of a misunderstanding, or because of in Yiftach's case, as the Midrash isolates, because of actually his ignorance, this is what occurred. But this just adds another... There's the one Midrash highlights the ego aspect that he didn't consult, but another part of the Midrash suggests that actually he wasn't learned, and therefore that's why he didn't react. So there's a number of both ignorance and ego which are...
There are ignorant people that
have... That's true. It can definitely happen to go. Sure.
What group?
Oh, so yeah, so this is interestingly over there. So a number of Farshim deal with this. The Malbim understands that it might refer to Shabbos because how does it work? The last day of the battle was Shabbos. It's not explicit in the Psukim, but he feels that by doing this, by putting such a cherem on, therefore causing people to carry out on Shabbos. I don't remember the exact things. The Malbim, I think, relates it to Shabbos. Other people do relate it to... I don't remember. I need to get back to you. I just did this recently. Now the Mepharshim describe what the bris is separate to the cherem in this pasuk over here, but it's not the same thing. It seems to be according to most of the Mepharshim. So that's just an interesting closing word. Where I think Tanakh itself is paralleling this very instance. But I'd like to, in the last few minutes over here, just to call this to a close. With unfortunately, it doesn't get happier at the end of Yiftach's life, and maybe it doesn't get happier for the same reason. because that's all we need to think about over here. So if you just turn for the moment to chapter 11, this is in the bottom of page 5. In the Civil War over here, we just have the end of Yiftach's life, which is highlighted and unfortunately not very happy either. So it says as follows. Vayisaek ish Ephraim vayavor tzafona. The ish Ephraim, which means to say the men of Ephraim as a whole, came to the north. Vayamru leYiftach, Madu avarta hilalachem ivnei Ammon? Why did you fight against the children of Ammon? V'lonu lo karasa, and you didn't call to us, l'leches imoch, and you didn't call us to battle as well, to fight. Because remember, Ephraim is the big tribe, which is in the region. They should have been called as allies. What's their threat? Be'ischon nisrof olecha ba'esh, we're going to burn your house. Meaning they're very upset by this whole incident that they weren't called to battle, specifically seeing as they're in battle. And this is a little bit of ego, unfortunately, as well. Vayomi Yiftach. Now, by the way, have we seen Ish Ephraim appearing in these kind of... Have we seen Ish Ephraim before appearing after battles and they were left out? No. We have seen them, because actually in Parakhes, the beginning of Parakhes in Shoftim, when Yiftach wages war against Midian, what happens? The same Ish Ephraim also appears and says, why did you leave us out? Mm-hmm. Now, what was Yiftach's... this is not Yiftach. What did Gideon respond at the time? Gideon responded very appeasingly. He said, you know what? Even the best of us aren't like the lowest of you. You know, you're the best. And we saw even the Radak said that his language was, he uses the letter vase as opposed to bays, because he's trying to be very appeasing. And they walk off. He's able to appease them, to flatter them enough that they move off. So now contrast that to the response of Yiftach. Yiftach's response is, Vayom Yiftach aleihem, Yiftach responds to them, Ish riva yisi aniva mi, uvnei amon me'od. I had a very fierce battle going on. Ve'ezak eschem, and I called you, v'lo yashatim osim yodam, but you didn't respond. Meaning, it's your problem, it's not my problem. You should have responded when you saw the battle happening, you should have joined me. Don't expect invitations from me in the middle of the battle. So it sounds like he's calling to them, but it sounds like he's saying that they didn't respond. So I'm not sure which one it is that he really called them, or just the battle itself was. I'm not sure on that. Or if it was an expected calling, or meaning like just by inference, or he actually sent messengers. I saw you not coming to save me. I put my soul in my hand. And I alone went against the Bnei Ammon, and God gave them in my hand. So now why are you getting upset? If you didn't want to save, either responding to the implicit call or the direct call of battle, then why are you getting upset now? And he waged war against them. There's a bit of a different response to Gideon, right? Vayaku anshe gilad es Ephraim, and they waged war against the children of Ephraim. Ki amru plitei Ephraim atem, because they called them the fugitives of Ephraim. Gilad are the people of Gilad, betoch Ephraim, betoch Menashe, and they try to weed out all the Ephraimites out of Gilad itself. And just to see the extent of how terrible this was, just the next two psukim. Vayichod Gilad es ma'abros yardeim Ephraim, and Gilad, which is on the east side of the Jordan, conquered the crossings of the Jordan of Ephraim. When the fugitives of Ephraim would ask to cross the river to get to Gilad, are you from Ephrat? Meaning, are you from the west bank of the Jordan? And you would say no. So they'd ask him, Shiboles. Well, can you say the word Shiboles? Shibolet. And so they apparently from the west side they had a bit of a mispronunciation. And they couldn't say it properly. They would grab them, and they kill him on the path of the Jordan. So these are people, the fugitives of Ephraim, trying to get back westwards. They'd stop them and have roadblocks to kill them.
Aren't there some Litvaks also who couldn't?
I was wondering about that as well.
Yes. There are some
Litvaks. It does continue. What was that?
I think the same thing happened in World War II. What they see with the Japanese, they couldn't pronounce a certain word.
Wasn't well, the Arabs can't pronounce B.
Doesn't that
I do. I do. That does ring a bell.
I can't remember all the details, but there was something in this.
That does ring a bell. Today, if you go to Ben Gurion Airport, you will be asked by a security guard to say hi, and if you can't pronounce the P, the Arabs don't pronounce P; they pronounce B. So they're listening for that as well. So yes. But no, they just say they just say hi to you, and they listen for any mispronunciations. Anyway, so it is very fascinating. So these things are in effect today, not to the same degree, but Vayipol ba'ezahi, and those and at that time they fell from Ephraim arboim ushnaim elef, 42,000 people. We're talking about a serious battle over here. And after that civil war, right? And by the way, this is not the only civil war in Shoftim, because we have later on the Pilegesh B'Geva, so just a precursor to this over here. Vayishpot Yiftach es Israel, and he judged the nation of Israel, Shesh Shanims for 6 years, Vayamos Yiftach HaGiladi, and he died, Vayikoveh Ba'arei Gilad, and he was buried in the hills of Gilad. We pointed out, in the Midrash, he pointed out that he was buried in different places because he lost limbs as he carried on living as a response to his daughter's neder. But what you see over here is again another tragedy over here, which is being expressed in this is that as a leader, he doesn't respond the same way as we saw a leader responding to almost exactly the same situation beforehand. Beforehand, we had Ephraim disgruntled for not being included. His response, as opposed to being appeasing or flattering, is to take it very offensively and in fact wage war till the very end to wipe out Ephraim. And really, in a certain sense, it's very, very strong aggressive over here. And the Midrash, and without going into it just because of time, the Midrash points out that at the core of this, well, the Mamlo Ez brings this, at the core of this is also a certain rigidity. Meaning, if you're able to be flexible, then you'll be able to, when you make a neder, to also consult people and see, can I change things? If you're flexible, when people insult you, you're able to take it. And you're able to bend with it. But this rigidity over here is something which is causing his reactions, both in terms of his daughter and in terms of the tribe of Ephraim, to be extremely strong.
Consistently,
and unfortunately, and so this tragedy continues. And here's something interesting to think about, is in a certain sense, Yiftach was trying to build his legacy. He tried to be this shofet who led the nation of Israel, ended up killing both his only daughter and a large section of one of the tribes of Israel, which is again just the dramatic irony of this person who's supposed to be the leader and building his legacy, losing everything that he expected. And he only ruled for a very short time. 6 years is a very short time in respect to other Shoftim. Sorry, Timon, you had a question?
I read something. I have to go look at it. Ephraim was guilty of human sacrifice.
Oh, really?
And I wonder if this might be one of the sources for that.
Interesting. So, meaning why the two are connected?
Why he was so angry with that?
That's interesting. I had not seen it before.
I
will point out just on that you should realize just two last points just on this thing over here. There's only two last things just to pull this in. Is that you should realize that although it is terrible that he killed them, that the Radak does point out that it couldn't have been that these were innocent people dying as well. Meaning he was going to be punished for doing this, but they were. He said there must have been some form of sin that Ephraim was involved with. He doesn't mention child sacrifice. He says that there was some form of secret problems that were going on undercover in Ephraim. And the people who needed to get what they were their due did get it. The Radak points this out. What? Yes, so Magalgalin Chet al Yidei Chayev, Choyv al Yidei Chayev. And the final thing over here, and I think this is interesting, is the Eliyahu Rabbah, which is a later Medrash, says over here that, in fact, who's responsible for all of this? This is just to throw in another span into the works. It is actually Pinchas. We already saw that Pinchas was indicted for not the neder, but where was he again as civil war developed? So this Eliyahu Rabbah just points out that as a leader you have to be so careful with the responsibility you have when things are developing under your jurisdiction, and he feels that this not only the neder was a failure on Pinchas's part, but also this battle as well. The fact that this battle could take place is also an indictment on Pinchas's leadership as well, not just Yiftach as well. Just to see this. Unfortunately, a very tragic story. Hopefully next time we start with Shimshon, which is a completely different kettle of fish.